The Spectator is searching for the UK's brightest entrepreneurs to enter the Spectator Economic Innovator of the Year Awards, in partnership with Charles Stanley Wealth Managers. If you have a business that disrupts an existing market, a smart new way of doing things, or something that has incredible social impact, then apply by the 9th of July at spectator.co.uk/innovator. Hello, I'm Sam Holmes, and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week, a few of our favourite writers read their pieces from the latest issue. This week, we'll hear from journalist Isabel Oakeshott about how she let the Matt Hancock scandal slip through her fingers a week before it turned up in the Sun. We'll also be joined by Melanie McDonough, who's written about how high tea has gone from an affordable British staple to an oversized and overpriced, but still delicious, monstrosity. And finally, John Day takes us into the wonderful world of competitive pigeon racing. First up, it's Isabel Oakeshott.
I want to apologise. I've let myself down. I've let others down too, and I'm sorry. Not because Matt Hancock style I breached social distancing guidelines with a steamy office affair, but because I missed the scoop. I was sent a compromising picture of the health secretary and his mistress almost a week before the Sun newspaper sensationally revealed their relationship. And I didn't believe it was him. Now, having never knowingly undersold my ability to break big stories, this is embarrassing to say the least. Over the years, my scoops have led variously to the jailing of a cabinet minister, Chris Huhne, the resignation of the UK's ambassador to Washington, Sir Kim Darroch, awkward questions to answer for William Hague after I revealed the married former Tory party leader was sharing a hotel bedroom with a young male aide, the embarrassment of Prince Andrew when I obtained a cache of his emails, and yes, that notorious story about a prime minister and a pig. Say what you like, but only the shock departure of teen heartthrob Zayn Malik from the band One Direction attracted more tweets and memes that year. So how did I miss this one? Well, here's what happened. On the morning of 20th of June, I was leafing through the Sunday newspapers when I received a message from an important contact. Good morning, this might brighten your day. I have a guy who says he has incriminating footage of Matt Hancock, he wrote breezily. Accompanying the text was a grainy image, no bigger than a postage stamp, of a man in a suit, leaning forward to embrace a raven-haired woman in a figure-hugging dress. What to do next? The message asked. Frankly, it looked nothing like Matt Hancock. Even now I know it's him, it still doesn't. Crooks, oddballs and cranks send journalists weird stuff all the time. My contact, a highly successful entrepreneur, certainly none of those things, but he did seem an unlikely recipient of this type of compromat. I peered at the picture. Could it really be the health secretary? I just didn't think so. I only had the one poor quality screen grab, not the video that would later be released, and no information about the original source. The picture had been sent to my contact via an untraceable Proton mail account. Moreover, the pandemic has sent all manner of conspiracy theorists and pranksters into overdrive, creating perilous working conditions for journalists. Private messaging groups on social media are awash with nonsense about Bill Gates' secret agenda to microchip the human race. There are umpteen very convincing-looking fake documents doing the rounds, all of which, annoyingly, I'm now going to have to take more seriously just in case I get it wrong. So my default position when it comes to these tips is to be ultra sceptical. Over the years, even the most brilliant journalists have fallen victim to hoaxes with devastating consequences. Piers Morgan, fired as editor of The Mirror in 2004 for publishing pictures purporting to show Iraqi prisoners being tortured by British Army soldiers. Those photos turned out to be fake. As editor of the Sunday Times back in the 80s, Andrew Neil, perhaps the finest journalist of our times, published the Hitler Diaries, which turned out to have been written by somebody else. Neil had done due diligence, drafting in the distinguished historian Hugh Trevor Roper to authenticate the material, but that didn't diminish the huge embarrassment for him and the paper when it turned out they were wrong. So it seemed vanishingly unlikely to me that the extraordinarily busy and apparently happily married health secretary would be frolicking around his office with a foxy brunette. Also, there was something funny about the image. which appeared to show an extra hand on the woman's back. "That's not Matt Hancock," I sniffed. "Wrong hairline. Looks more like..." Another MP whose private life is of no public interest. "Also, the picture is really weird. Looks as if it's been doctored. Those aren't his arms around her waist. If he has more footage, let's see it." My contact agreed that his source was probably a chancer, but said he would see what else he could get. "No rush," the original source had said when they discussed arrangements for viewing the full video, and then he or she hot-footed it to the sun. So, mea culpa. Like Matt Hancock, I am an idiot. My contact, an anti-establishment figure with a dim view of politicians in general and a particular disdain for the architects of the lockdown policy, would have relished his part in exposing Hancock's hypocrisy. I let him down. And I am left hungrier than ever for the next political scalp. This one was the one that got away. Note to other politicians with skeletons, and the next one will not slip through my grasp.
That was Isabel Oakeshott, and now Melanie McDonough.
The other day I came across a description of afternoon tea written by Alfred Douglas in 1920. Two kinds of bread and butter, white and brown, cucumber and tomato sandwiches cut razor thin, scones, rock buns, and then all the cakes, plum, Madeira, caraway seed. The meal had about it the lavishness of a Victorian dinner. There are a few things about this feast which I find striking. It includes two kinds of bread and butter. Sliced bread and butter never features on the modern table, but a century ago, people used it to fill themselves up. It took the edge off your appetite. Note also the simplicity of the cucumber and tomato sandwiches. Both are excellent if they're made from good stuff. The crucial thing was that they were cut thin. Scones survive today, but rock buns are rarities. Big cakes like Madeira and caraway seed were essentially plain cakes, Madeira being a simple butter sponge and caraways the crucial element of seed cake, a forgotten taste. Plum cake was rich fruit cake. That was afternoon tea a century ago. There were, of course, variants. Watercress sandwiches, maybe. But in this impressive assembly, what was interesting was how the essentials were simple, designed to fill you up as cheaply as possible. As a meal, afternoon tea used to be the cheap way to eat summer swanky. It has had something of a renaissance in recent years. Today you'll find afternoon tea in any grand establishment that wants to show off its traditional credentials. It's changed utterly, though. I've just been to tea at Claridge's, and the menu was extraordinarily elaborate. After the excellent sandwiches, poached salmon, Scottish, with lemon and tarragon mayonnaise, Dorrington ham, with a nasturtium, crisp shallot, mustard and celeriac remoulade on onion bread, there were scones with Marco Polo gelée. Then the patisseries, Earl Grey Macaron, raspberry and blackcurrant cheesecake, strawberry and mascarpone tart, vanilla religieuse. It was all fabulous, but not cheap. Afternoon tea was once an inexpensive treat. It now costs £70, or 80, with a glass of champagne. At Fordham & Mason, the Jubilee Tea Salon is humming. You need to book way ahead. There are five menus: classic, savoury, vegan, dairy-free or gluten-free. The savoury one includes a Portland crab scone with white crab and apple mayonnaise, Ragston goat's cheese with grape and walnut, smoked trout mousse, and Keta caviar and a squail scotch egg with curry mayonnaise. It costs £65, or, for a tea tasting with a tea rister to talk you through it, an extra £12.50 per table. All this stuff is delicious, but it is a far cry from a traditional afternoon tea. In the Constance Spry cookery book, first published in 1956, the author reflected, "The very word tea time has a nostalgic ring for those of us who remember the past with delight. In those days, the disposition of a woman's time made tea time possible, and the taste for, shall I say, the cosier figure gave no cause for apprehension. She identified the finer points of the meal. It was not then considered good taste to have too many small things. One good plum cake, one light cake, perhaps of the sponge or sponge sandwich variety, or an orange cake, iced, might appear, and a hot dish of crumpets or buttered toast, anchovy toast, or hot tea cakes, and that admirable hot cake described as Irish Sally Lunn. This is a meal for a good appetite, and, except for the fruit cake, neither overly rich nor extravagant, though it made a very good show. The working-class tea was simply the evening meal, mostly savoury. The modern afternoon tea is designed for the modern palate, which is wary of wheat flour, but addicted to sugar and unfamiliar with the former staples of the tea table. It is far richer than the Edwardian and post-war meal, far heavier on sugar, far lighter on starchy carbs, way more elaborate and unrecognisably more expensive. It's a bit of a metaphor, then, for contemporary London. Constance Spry would have found it over the top and absurdly expensive. We no longer do restrain simplicity, which means we're missing out on the humble pleasure of a buttered crumpet. As for sliced bread and butter, I think it has due return.
That was Melanie McDonough, and finally we have John Day.
The Mysterious World of Pigeon Racing by John Day. Pigeon racing isn't much of a spectator sport. Race birds are driven to the liberation point, where they're released to fly back to their homes. Only the liberation and the return are witnessed. What happens in between is a mystery. This is partly what makes pigeon racing so fascinating. It's also what can make it so stressful. A week ago, between 5 and 10,000 pigeons went missing during a race from Peterborough. Usually fanciers aren't too worried if a few birds don't make it straight home from a race. They'll rest up and return a few days later, no worse for wear. But this time the losses were exceptionally large. "I've never heard of anything like this," said Ian Evans, manager of the Royal Pigeon Racing Association. "It's a real mystery." Racing pigeons are closely related to feral pigeons, themselves urban relatives of Columba livia, the rock dove, but have been selectively bred over thousands of years to have an unrivalled ability to find their way home. Quite how they do so isn't fully understood. There is some evidence that, like migratory songbirds, pigeons can detect the Earth's magnetic field. Fanciers have speculated that the Peterborough losses might have been caused by a solar storm interfering with this mechanism. The Met Office says no unusual activity has been recorded. It also seems likely that they navigate using an olfactory gradient map, produced by smells carried on prevailing winds. However it works, this homing ability has made pigeons one of our oldest companion species. They were used to break the sieges of Medina and Paris, and won awards for bravery during both world wars. Pigeon racing was invented by Belgian coal miners at the end of the 19th century. The sport depended on two other things: the railways, which allowed fanciers to send their birds far from home for training, and mass-produced clocks, which enabled them to record their flying times accurately. For a time, pigeon racing was one of the most popular sports by participation in Europe. In Britain in the 1950s, 500,000 fanciers tended millions of birds. Now, in the West at any rate, pigeon racing is in decline. At 37, I am the youngest member of my club by quite a margin. This is partly reputational. The stock of the pigeon, so high in the post-war years when they were seen as heroes, has plummeted. Some flyers blame an increase in the raptor population. Brexit, too, is having an effect. Last week, fanciers lobbied the government to end new animal health regulations which threatened to make cross-channel racing impossible. In China and Central Asia, the sport is flourishing. Last year, a Chinese fancier paid a record £1.4 million for a champion Belgian bird named New Kim. But in Britain, pigeon racing has become very much a minority pursuit. With luck, most of the missing Peterborough pigeons will find their way home. I once lost a bird on a flight from Cambridge. He turned up, unruffled, 6 months later. But some might choose not to return at all. These will join their feral cousins on the streets of our towns and cities. Next time you pass a flock, you might see if you can spot one.
That was John Day. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud. If you enjoy this podcast, please do rate and review our Best of the Spectator channel and pick up an issue of the Spectator magazine by going to spectator.co.uk/voucher to get 12 weeks of the Spectator for just £12, as well as a £20 Amazon gift voucher. Thank you for listening, and join us again next week.